second hour of It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. It's time for this week's in-depth interview with a special guest from the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
And if you just joined us, I'd like to let you know this is a two-hour show in which we balance the creative with the intellectual and explore whether we have more in common than divides us. And we do this by featuring thought-provoking conversations out and about with people on the street in the first hour of the show on a different topic each week. And then in the second hour, inspiring conversations with special guests from the arts. And remember, you can always go to the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com to find podcasts of all previous shows, or if you enjoy this show today, to hear it again or tell your friends about it. So again, it's aquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week is my special guest from the arts. I'm pleased to be interviewing internationally renowned, award-winning filmmaker Nico von Glazou. Born in Cologne, Nico studied film at New York University and the Film Academy in Lodz, Poland, where he made his first feature film, Wedding Guests. Written and directed by Nico, the film won numerous awards, including the German Critics Prize at the Berlin Film Festival. Nico's next projects, including Marie's Song, Winter Sleepers and Edelweiss Pirates, were shown at festivals around the world and won multiple awards. For his next film, Nobody's Perfect, Nico convinced 11 fellow victims of thalidomide to pose for a nude calendar and documented the whole process. The film's worldwide success gave Nico an opportunity to meet with politicians and journalists. This campaign resulted in the German government increasing compensation to surviving victims of thalidomide in Germany. Nico's other films include Lazy Lama, about a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who teaches all over the world, My Way to Olympia, about the 2012 London Paralympics, the award-winning Everything Will Be Alright, which documents the making of a unique live theatre production, which includes mentally and physically disabled actors, and Shoot Me, Kiss Me, Cut. Nico is a member of BAFTA, as well as the European and German Film Academy. He founded the Tibetan Film School and holds talks and workshops in script writing and directing internationally. He is also a highly regarded motivational speaker. Nico's film career is complemented by his artistic photographic work. He adapts his methods as a director to his photography, arranging people and situations to portray conceptually their personalities and unique characteristics. And the photographs which accompanied his film Nobody's Perfect and were published as a calendar and a book have been exhibited widely, including at the prestigious National Portrait Gallery in London. Nico is currently working on several photographic projects, including with blind, deaf, dumb children, prostitutes and juvenile prisoners in the Philippines. He is also developing several film projects through the international production company he founded, Palladio Film. Welcome to the show, Nico.
Hello.
Well, thanks so much for making the time to talk to us. And you're a writer, director, producer and photographer. I'm wondering if you can remember your first experience of art where you realized the sort of power of art rather than just its entertainment value.
Oh, that was around when I was 5 years old. I remember very well. My father was a publisher for art books, so this was 1966. So our house was full of artists, and because I have short arms because of thalidomide, so I'm not very good in painting or, you know, these things, or playing the piano. So I was always sitting next to artists and telling them what to do. So there was, for example, Pollock. Jackson Pollock, and I told him, you know, why don't you put some color on it? And it was real. I started to direct other people, other artists, very early.
Wow, that's amazing. Gosh, at five. So you were, even at that age, projecting your sort of artistic vision out.
Yeah, I'm, unfortunately, I'm You could ask my wife. I'm directing all the time, everybody.
Oh, so Jackson Pollock can put down his success to the five-year-old Nico von Glasu.
No.
I'm just joking.
Unfortunately, he didn't listen to me because I told him also to not to drink too much, but he didn't.
Didn't like that advice.
No.
So you were fortunate to grow up in this really creative environment and to be directed, I suppose, yourself by events into direction. When did you know that you wanted to pursue film professionally?
The same time, when I was five. I knew, that I want to make films, so I started with a little 6x6 camera and I always knew that I want to direct, not necessarily film. Yeah, I can also direct a fashion show or a photo or a painting, or I can I love, for example, to make parties. Mm-hmm. I'm really good in I don't like to go to parties. I never, ever, ever. Please don't invite me to any party because I just don't come. But to make parties, I'm really good.
Oh, well, like themed parties and things like that?
Yeah, 3 days in Venice, yeah? You ever want to have a party in Venice, tell me.
Okay. That sounds good to me, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good to know. So you studied film at New York University and the Film Academy in, is it Lodz? How do you pronounce that? L-O-D-Z?
Łódź.
Łódź, okay.
Łódź. Łódź. In Polish and Lodz in German.
Okay. Can you tell us what it was like making your first film? Like, an actual film, because I know you said from a child you were making things.
It was 2 years before the wall in Berlin fall. So it was precisely the last 2 years of communism. Mm. And it was amazing. It was because the people were, so wonderful. Yeah. But there was no pepper, there was no pizza, there was no basilicum, there was no spaghetti.
Huh.
And it sounds, the first 2 months I said, oh, no problem. But after a few months, no spaghetti, that was really, it sounds very terrible of me, but it is, and it was so gray. Everything was gray, yeah?
Yeah.
The color gray was so, certainly we made black and white films. But on the other hand, the warmth of the people was just wonderful.
Mm. I was just going to say, it's interesting you talking about the things that you missed, and there's so many things that seem everyday to us that we really do take for granted, aren't there? That you don't really even know what they are until you don't have them.
Yes. I think really, my whole family is kind of insane. And my wife once, I asked my wife once, why do you think that I'm not so insane? Yeah.
Right.
And she said, because you have short arms. Your life started with a big and then it went up and up and up. Yeah.
Right.
But when you have really everything, I notice more and more I don't like rich people.
Hmm.
Yeah? I don't like spoiled rich people, yeah? Mm. I have some friends who are wonderful and rich, but it's very difficult to stay compassionate and nice when you're rich, obviously, yeah?
Mm.
And a lot of people are quite rich in our world.
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of, I always call it like believing your own PR. People start to believe they are more and better just because they have money rather than that they're just rich,
They made an experiment in America. They let people play Monopoly, and they gave some of the players very little money, and then they gave the other players a lot of money. And then the players with a lot of money won. Yeah?
Yeah.
And then they interviewed them afterwards. Why do you think did you win? And 95% of the people who win said, oh, I'm very talented with money, and I always had a finger for money. So they don't realize it's basically because you had a lot of money.
Right. Yeah? That's interesting.
So a lot of rich people think they are successful because they are talented. No, they're rich because they're born rich. Yeah?
Right, yes, yeah.
And that gives them an arrogance which they are not deserve. Yeah?
Yes.
It's a problem. And that's also maybe why I really enjoy, now I'm working in Vietnam a lot, with, there are 3 million survivors of Agent Orange. Agent Orange.
Gosh, yes.
And they are blind, deaf, short arms, short legs, and, you know, really in a terrible situation. And but very kind people, and they help each other. You know, the blind is carrying the lame, and neither the American government, neither the Vietnamese government give them anything. They live on $20 a month.
Oh, my goodness.
If they're lucky.
Yes.
But on the other hand, you know, life is not all that simple. Their life is not only miserable. Their life is also amazingly beautiful because they have to form friendships. They have to help each other.
Yes.
And they are not lonely. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
So they give me a lot of joy. I mean, last week I made a big party in Ho Chi Minh City. And that was great.
Yeah. I mean, I think what you're speaking to is, you know, the complexity of life. And I was talking to a guest I had last week, Ihab Shanti, who works in the Middle East. We're providing a platform for artists. And part of the motivation of that was to create an opportunity for a more complex picture of the region to be put forward, because we tend to just think of it as conflict and everybody, you know, suffering and all the rest of it. And of course, like you're saying, in these situations, often from the outside, we just see one thing. And I'm sure as a filmmaker, you must be, you know, very motivated and inspired to show the complexity of these situations.
Yeah, I see myself less and less as a filmmaker. I really enjoy to make things happen. Yeah? I mean,
yeah.
You know, because why do we make films? Why do we do what we do with our life? Basically, to be happy.
Right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And I noticed that, you know, when I do projects with poor people or people who need my presence, it makes me more happy than film, yeah?
Right.
I mean, if I make films, yeah, but that's not my center. There are so many wonderful things to do on this planet.
I mean, I think making a difference can make one happy. And through the kind of films you're making, I think you are making a difference. So perhaps, you know, in that sense, I mean, I hear what you're saying about
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you mentioned in your introduction the film Nobody's Perfect. We made with this film 2.5 billion euros.
Wow.
2.5 billion we got out of the German government. Not billion, 2.5 billion.
Goodness. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of, you know, then, you know, that makes me happy.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I wanted to talk more about Nobody's Perfect. We have to go to a break now, so when we come back, let's definitely do that. If you just joined us, I'm talking to my special guest from the arts this week, internationally renowned award-winning filmmaker Nico von Glasu. We're going to go to a break now. We'll be back after these messages.
like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and I've been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 48 years. We are a one-stop shop for all your holiday needs, including books, gifts, children's books, toys, holiday cards, puzzles, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right gift for everyone on your list. If you want something special, we feature mini autograph books by best-selling authors at no extra charge. If you can't get downtown, our website has 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copeland, and my guest from the arts this week, award-winning filmmaker Nico von Glazou. And before the break, we started to talk about Nico's film, Nobody's Perfect. And I'd like to read something you've written allied to this film, Nico. You write, I'm a filmmaker who has short arms due to the effects of the drug thalidomide. The first thing people react to when they meet me is how I look. Even if they don't say anything, they either stare or look away. They show that they're uncomfortable around me. I can hardly blame them. I'm very uncomfortable about it myself. All my life, I've tried not to think about my disability, tried to ignore the truth. Many disabled people find it hard to deal with the disgusted, confused, or pitying stares they receive when they're out in public. Society needs to get used to the way we look and stop seeing us as beings from another planet. Of course we look different, but it is possible to see beyond that. I found a way to help make that happen. And the film Nobody's Perfect, along with the accompanying book and calendar, met with worldwide success. I was wondering if you can tell us about the process of how you thought of doing this film and how you found the subjects for it and how you brought your vision to the screen.
Yeah, that it's a nice story because I wanted to make a feature movie on thalidomide, and the producers and the money people in Germany didn't allow me to do that, and they wanted me to do a documentary on thalidomide. Mm. And I was so angry because I wanted to make a movie, a proper movie, and that was in Cannes in front of the big hotel, and I screamed at these people, and I really was angry. And then I went home to my wife, and when I went into the bed of my wife because I came very late. She switched on the lights and said, "What's wrong, Nico?" And I said, I told her the story, and then she said, "Nico, it's time to look the devil in the ass, because I never wanted to look at the truth that I'm disabled, believe it or not."
Mm.
And my wife, being a scriptwriter, she said, "Okay, I tell you the story of your documentary. You find 12 thalidomides for a nude calendar, and you have to be Mr. December, because my biggest fear going to the beach, you know, because then people stare at me at even more."
Mm.
So I found very quickly the others. They I called friends from, you know, childhood.
Mm.
And they all said, "Yes, yes, yes, we do it." Yeah.
Mm. Right.
The only problem was that I didn't want to do it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And but then when the day came that I had to strip in front of a photo camera for this nude calendar, I was so busy directing, so it was not so bad.
Right, yeah.
And then something wonderful happened, because the film was so successful, and I was standing in front of, you know, thousands of people, and I had to say, "My name is Nico, I am disabled."
Mm.
And that is very liberating, when you say in front of lots of people the truth. Yeah?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, it sounds a bit crazy, because everybody can see that I'm disabled, yeah?
Right.
But I never admitted it. You know, it's like an alcoholic. Everybody knows that he's an alcoholic, yeah?
Yes.
But it's very difficult to admit it, yeah?
Yes.
And that was very, very helpful for me. I mean, it was just wonderful, yeah?
Mm. So I wanted to ask you, social constructionism has been used by the disability movement to try and redefine the perception of those with disabilities and show that their relative powerlessness is not inherent in their condition, but is more a result of their interaction with their environment and the non-disabled. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, and whether with your film projects you're trying to change the discourse on disability and sort of challenge the cultural imperialism of the dominant group, you know, the non-disabled.
I mean, number one, everybody's disabled. Just in my case, you can see it better, and in your case, it's better hidden.
Yes.
Yeah? So people should realize that we are just an image of your inside. So, and, you know, everybody's disabled. And number two, we have to fight for our rights and for our being like women in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
It is just, you know, today I don't get a job. I never, ever, nobody wanted ever to produce my movies. I could get as much money or prices. Nobody gives me the job.
Right.
You don't employ disabled people for highly paid jobs.
Why do you think that is?
It is just, you know, you don't employ, now it's changing, God thanks, but you didn't employ blonde women.
Right.
It's just
a prejudice of sort of a lesser person or something.
Yeah, and it is. So basically, that's why one day I'm rich, and I wanted to be rich. You know, because when I ask someone in the street, "Can you tell me a good restaurant?" they always send me to the pizza place. They never, you know, they always think I have no money.
Yes.
Yeah. I can wear, you know, 5 cashmere pullovers, but it doesn't matter.
Mm.
They don't look at me. They just send me to the pizza place. So I decided to become rich. And I'm now really, really rich. I made a lot of money with Apple and other stock market things.
Uh-huh.
And now I bought a villa in Tuscany. 2,000 square meter big villa for 125 bedrooms. And I created the most beautiful, amazing holiday house you can imagine.
Right.
And it is, one of my new projects, a Villa Pozzolo. It's you know, you get whatever. Once you rent the villa, you get whatever you like. You can drink my wine, you can have a cook, you have a you can marry, you have a church, you have a swimming pool, you have a personal trainer. If you want a yoga teacher, you get a yoga teacher. You whatever you want, you will get.
Yes.
And it's all included in one price, but the price is very high.
Right.
So, but that is a political statement for me. You know, not, you know, I'm disabled and rich.
Right. Yes.
And this is a contradiction in the mind of most people.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I was just thinking in a way, seeing people seeing you as rich or seeing a person as rich and then changing their opinion about them is still not really seeing the true person within, is it, though? I understand what you're saying. You're challenging cultural prejudices, and I think that's great. But I'm just saying it's kind of sad that that's the way we challenge it, you know what I mean, by having to do things like that so that people see, oh, it is possible. They can't just think that it's possible on their own.
If you get a female president in the United States, which I hope, it will change.
Yes, yeah.
The perception, you know, we have, as disabled people, we have to prove it.
Yeah, no, I see.
Nobody
that.
Will do it for us.
No, yeah.
So I have to prove it.
Yeah. There's also an interesting thing. I mean, social constructionism is a lot about the power of language and how language sort of defines things. And a while back, you know, there was this impetus in the mental health arena to stop saying like people are depressed or they have they're schizophrenic or whatever, and instead to say they have depression or they have schizophrenia. And I would imagine it's the same thing. If you have an impairment, you have a disability, it doesn't become the whole of you. If you say somebody's disabled, it's like that is all that they are. Do you know what I mean? Is their disability. Whereas, like you're saying, all of us have disabilities, whether they be psychological or emotional or mental or whatever it is, but they're not like out there for everyone to see. But it's only such a small part of who somebody is.
No, it is a big part.
A big part. Well,
it's a big part. It's a big truth. And I think it would be good if I would say, wow, I'm disabled. This gives me a strength and a wisdom and possibilities in life, which are amazing, you know. I shouldn't, you know, see it as a defect, but I should see it as a wonderful opportunity, yeah?
Right.
I mean, I can go to the, you know, the poorest slums in Vietnam or in China or wherever, and people like me. Most people can't, yeah? Mm-hmm. I can talk, you know, I have possibilities other people don't.
Right.
And it's a blessing. I asked even my Tibetan Buddhist teacher. He told me also, I asked him, you know, maybe I did something really bad in my last life. And he said, no, maybe you were an especially wonderful person in your last life. And now, you know, you have these short arms as a blessing. And that is the thinking, yeah?
I see, yes.
It is not, yeah. We shouldn't, you know, apologize for being a woman or black or whatever. We should say, wow, yeah?
Yes.
It's wonderful, yeah?
Yeah.
Thank you, God. You gave me my short arms, so I have more compassion for other people. I understand that life is not that, you know, wonderful for everybody.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's the way to do it, yeah?
Yeah. No, I see that.
And you know, each time I meet people, when they say, oh, when I was young, I worked with disabled people, that was the best time in my life.
Mm.
Or they say, oh, I have this friend. She is such a wonderful person, but she sits in a wheelchair.
Mm.
So how often have you heard how wonderful disabled people are?
Yes.
So what's the problem?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
We are wonderful.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah?
Well, I think, you know, through your films, you're certainly demonstrating that. I mean, you, not just through Nobody's Perfect, but your other films as well. And I'm wondering, you write, direct, you produce, all of those things are huge in themselves. Do you do all of them because you love all of them? Is that the best way that it works? Are they all part of the same creative process to you, or does each different area inspire you?
I mean, I produce movies because nobody else does it.
Right.
Yeah? I mean, and I will not ever produce another film in my life. I hate it. I think producing really sucks. I write scripts because I'm good in construction of stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so good in writing. I mean, I mean, script writers, really good script writers, are so rare. That I wasted so much time and trying. Yeah. So it's faster to do it myself. And directing comes natural. I don't, you know, it's a joy and it's easy and I'm completely relaxed and, you know, it's very easy for me.
Right. And you have a film production company called Palladio Film. I was curious about the significance of the name.
Yeah, when, I don't know, 30 years ago when I established the company, I noticed that, you know, ships before had a saint, you know, the name of the saint was the name of the ship.
Mm.
So I was thinking, who is the artist I could, you know, name, kind of use as my saint for my company? And Palladio, Andrea Palladio, was an architect in the Renaissance.
Ah.
And it's one of my favorite artists. And there, the whole Palladian style of all the beautiful American and French villas are coming, and that is Andrea Palladio.
Ah, interesting. Well, I wanted to let listeners know that they can go to your website, Palladio Film, which is PalladioFilm.com, PalladioFilm.com. It's a wonderful website where you can find information out about all Nico's films and also his photographic work. So again, that's PalladioFilm.com. We're going to go to a break now.
And but you can find me also on Facebook.
Oh, okay, on Facebook and I'm sure on lots of other places. Excellent. Okay, well, we're going to go to a break now. We'll be back with Nico after these messages. And again, that's PalladioFilm.com. And are you on Twitter as well?
No.
So Facebook is the place to go. So are you very active on Facebook?
Yes, I love it. I love it. I think it's wonderful.
Great. Okay. Well, I'm sure listeners would love to engage with you there.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to go to some messages now. We'll be back soon.
Imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made dessert in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Coplin, and my special guest from the arts, renowned award-winning filmmaker Nico von Glazou. We've talked quite a bit about your films. You've made a really interesting range of films, including Lazy Lama, about a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, Everything Will Be All Right, which is about a unique live theatre production, and My Way to Olympia, about the 2012 London Paralympics, to mention just a few of your films. I'm wondering what criteria you use to decide whether a subject is something you want to make a film about, whether it be a documentary or fiction.
How films come to you like, you know, dogs. I mean, they come and then they stay with you or they go away. It's not that I can decide that. You know, it's not in my power. It comes, you know, then.
Do you mean inspirationally it comes to you?
It's kind of, you know, you start thinking about many things every day, I do, and then suddenly it grows and you just have to listen to the world, and then you hear it. It's coming.
Yes.
I don't know.
How much of your desire to make films is fueled by social justice, would you say?
Partly not at all, because I like to tell stories, and I don't like, you know, films with a big message, and I have to tell now, teach people how to think.
Mm.
Not at all. I mean, I really don't like these kind of message movies.
Right,
I make films and I tell stories about human beings, and if my film is, by the way, because, you know, if artists try to show that they are good, then it's horrible.
I agree.
I mean, either you do what you do and you do it as good as you can, and if you are a good person, it will show. If you are not such a good person, it will show too. So don't worry too much.
Mm.
Just do what you do.
That's an interesting approach. I imagine because you're, you know, based in Europe, that you're outside the sort of Hollywood system, and a lot of that seems to be very much about trying to show what you do to a certain aspect. Do you think there's a different sort of approach to filmmaking in Europe?
Not by the good people. I mean, not,
right.
I think we have the all kinds of filmmakers, and in Hollywood the same. The budgets are different. Yeah.
Right.
And
yeah.
But the No, it's the same thing.
So it's the same kind of thing. You can make a good film if you're coming from the right place anywhere.
Yeah.
And if you get lost in trying to make it about making money and messaging and all of that, then wherever you are, it's going to be a bad film.
Yes, it is. It's the same. You know, we are all on the whole. We are all the same. You know, our problems are the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe my problems, you know, a bit. But no. If you have a film with $10 million, you have the same problems when they're for $1 million, because it's the same problem. You have to tell a good story in a good way. I mean,
No, I can see that. Yes. Yeah. I think perhaps one of the challenging things when you get up into a bigger budget is when a film ends up being made by committee, because it has to go through so many, you know, people who are
that
involved.
That is in Europe the same. We have more committees than you have.
Oh, really?
I mean, no, we get subsidies, and subsidies are done by committees. Yeah,
I mean, right.
No. We have the committees. You have some people decide.
Yeah. So I think that always is a challenge for artists, where there's sort of committees of whatever type that are trying to have their 2 cents worth, you know, in the process. Yeah, definitely. I was very interested in your film Shoot Me, Kiss Me, Cut, because you started with a script, but you quickly got rid of that and instead made a film with 100 hours of improvised scenes. I was just wondering, as a filmmaker, how does it differ working with a script and then with, you know, pure improvisation like that?
I mean, if you're not a genius scriptwriter, you have no other way than using improvisation to improve your dialogue and your life.
That's a very honest answer.
Because, you know, it's actors can give you so much, and, you know, it's can be such a joy when you know your plot. Know what you need, then you can be very open for improvisation. Yeah.
Right. Yes.
If you don't know what you're doing, then you're in trouble. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you have to have a structure within.
Yeah, I didn't tell anyone, but I had the idea to make a remake of Pretty Woman, mixed with Romeo and Juliet.
Mm.
So I knew both stories quite well. Pretty Woman, I've seen, I don't know, 30 times.
Hmm.
And Romeo and Juliet too.
Right.
So I had both stories were very clear in my mind. And from then on, I could, you know, I knew what I need. Yeah?
Yes.
I need the girl and the rich boy and, you know, they have, and I need, always knew where I am. Yeah? Mm.
Yes. Yeah.
And, and a good plot, you know, is everything.
Yes, yeah. So how does 100 hours of footage compare with the footage you would generate for a scripted film? Is that a lot more or I have no idea.
No, it's not.
It's not? Oh,
no,
really?
Because
wow.
If you shoot, you just have to, you put your footage into layers, so you have, you sync all your cameras.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the poor editor has to do this because we were shooting with mobile phones most of the time.
Mm.
And then you cut the film, then it's much less, you know, then you have only 10 hours. And then but you have to first organize your material and then...
So you end up with 10 hours because you've got a lot of footage of the same scenes, and so you layer that down and then you choose. I see.
Yes.
Okay. Right.
And then you can start editing.
Wow. Gosh. That's...
no, but...
overwhelming.
You need amazing good editors.
Yes.
And you need more than one. Yeah?
Yeah.
Because you know, after seeing so much footage, you get very tired. So you have to tell the first editor, you go this way, and then you stop, and then you give it to someone else, because you cannot, you burn out.
Yes.
After a while. Yeah?
That makes sense.
So you have to be very honest to your editors before. You say, okay, you do it 6 weeks, and the next one do it 6 weeks, and then you come back. Yeah?
Right, yes.
But don't, you know, otherwise you have to fire them, and that's not very pleasant.
No. But that makes sense, because it's the same in music production. You know, after a while, you've just heard the track so many times that, I mean, the danger is that you think it's really, really good because you've just heard it so many times or whatever, and then you need either to go away for a month and come back to it, to come to it fresh, or like your approach at that would work too, to have someone else's eyes on it. Yeah, definitely. So how much involvement do you as a director have on the editing process?
Everything. I mean, I leave the editor very often alone weeks. Yeah. Because then I can also see my film again. But I'm the producer, director, and scriptwriter, so nobody can tell me anything except people like the editor, because they are my friends and they know their job better than I do. So I listen to my editor, certainly.
Yeah. So you would come back and see what they've done, and then you would know whether that's your vision or not. Yeah. So you've made documentaries and fictional films. What are the different appeals of each of those for you?
There is less and less I think there's no big difference, because you still have to structure your story. Yeah,
right.
You need, when you make documentary or fiction for the cinema, meaning this has a certain, you know, it's 2 hours.
Yeah.
And then you need a beginning, and you need to get the audience in, and you have to keep them in the story. Yeah. And it's you know, also my so-called fiction films. I was shooting, for example, this film Edelweiss Pirates, which took place 1944 in Cologne in the Nazi time, and I shot it in St. Petersburg in Russia.
Mm.
And I asked always my actors to go out in the street in their costume.
Mm.
When anyone was looking at that more than normal, I changed the costume so the costume looked shabby, but like today, not too costume-like.
Right.
And then also there, in this film, I used three cameras all the time, and I improvised also a lot, because this was in the war, so people had to run and to hide from the bombs and from the Gestapo and so on. And I wanted to give the feeling of a documentary of this movie. Yeah.
Mm.
So I also improvised a lot.
Right. Yeah. So there's kind of a weaving of truth and fiction in both.
Yeah.
And of course, life is a story, isn't it? Yeah.
Good actors know so much more about their character and their situation than me.
Mm.
Yeah. And this ego thing of a lot of directors, that they think they are in control. It's a complete misunderstanding. The more films I make, the more I realize how little control I have.
Mm.
I can only pray to God to help me to get this thing together. Yeah, I mean, it's not that you can, you know, decide really what's happening.
That seems a long way from the five-year-old you that wanted to direct everything and be in control of everything. Is that an evolution?
Sure, there's two sides, I certainly still want to control everything, but I understand more and more I cannot.
Mm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's just, you know, we are not in control. We are not, we are not in control.
Yes. Yeah.
And the more we want to control our relationships, our behavior, the behavior of others, we want to change the world. Yeah, I mean, you know, half of the destruction of this world is done by people who want to change the world.
Yes, yeah. To their own way of seeing it, yes.
Yeah.
We have a couple of minutes left, so this question probably segues into that. I'm wondering what the importance of art is in the world, do you think? What part do you think art plays in the world?
Nazis and, you know, communists or totalitarians destroy art. They hate art, yeah? So art is amazingly important. Culture, let's call it culture, not so much art, yeah? I mean, art is such a snobby thing, but culture, that we have something, beauty or inspiration in our life to be creative, yeah? That we can do things, yeah? And it's so wonderful these days that we can do, you know, everybody can go and do some pottery or photography. It's never in history of human beings, it was so wonderful that we can do so much.
Yes.
And it is, I think art is so important to do, make art, and to be surrounded by art. It's you die if you don't do it.
Yes.
Your soul is dying. You know, it's amazingly important.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that before, about the ability now to make art being so different from the past. That is true. I mean, not everybody does, but the potential to be creative and make art is there for everyone, isn't it, on various levels.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of my friends are depressed, have depression, or and I really think when you go and sing, for example, go and sing every day 1 hour, it will help your depression.
Yes.
Do something, especially singing and dancing, the two art forms which are the oldest art forms, painting too, I do now I do a big competition. Paint or draw the most horrible thing what happened in your life. And I do it especially in Asia, but all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's amazing what people do there. And when you turn your suffering into art.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yes. No, I can imagine that. That's a wonderful thing that you're offering people. Well, thank you so much, Nico, for coming on the show.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I just want to remind listeners again that they can go to palladiofilm.com, palladiofilm.com, and you can find out more about Nico's wonderful films and his photography. And remember, our website is itsaquestionofbalance.com. See you next week.